And now,
the definition. Definition.
Gentlemen, let's have
the pause button because the president's here now.
Approaching the podium right now, being introduced by Klaus Schwab, who is the head of the World Economic Forum again. Donald Trump taking the stage here in Davos.
Congratulations on your 50th year hosting the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum, a truly amazing achievement. It's an honor to address the distinguished members of this organization for the second time as president. When I spoke at this forum 2 years ago, I told you that we had launched the Great American Comeback. Today, I'm proud to declare that the United States is in the midst of an economic boom, the likes of which the world has never seen before. We've regained our stride, rediscovered our spirit, and reawakened the powerful machinery of American enterprise. America is thriving, America is flourishing, and yes, America is winning again like never before. Just last week alone, the United States concluded two extraordinary trade deals, the agreement with China and the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, the two biggest trade deals ever made. They just happened to get done in the same week. These agreements represent a new model of trade for the 21st century, agreements that are fair, reciprocal, and that prioritize the needs of workers and families. America's economic turnaround has been nothing short of spectacular. When I took office 3 years ago, America's economy was in a rather dismal state. Under the previous administration, nearly 200,000 manufacturing jobs had vanished. Wages were flat or falling. Almost 5 million more Americans had left the labor force than had gotten jobs, and more than 10 million people had been added to the food stamp rolls. The experts predicted a decade of very, very slow growth, or maybe even negative growth, high unemployment and a dwindling workforce, and very much a shrinking middle class. Millions of hardworking, ordinary citizens felt neglected, betrayed, forgotten. They were rapidly losing faith in the system. Before my presidency began, the outlook for many nations was bleak. Top economists warned of a protracted worldwide recession. The World Bank lowered its projections for global growth to a number that nobody wanted to even think about. Pessimism had taken root deep in the minds of leading thinkers, business leaders, and policymakers. Yet despite all of the cynics, I had never been more confident in America's future. I knew we were on the verge of a profound economic resurgence if we did things right, one that would generate a historic wave of investment, wage growth, and job creation. I knew that if we unleashed the potential of our people, if we cut taxes, slashed regulations, and we did that at a level that's never been done before in the history of our country in a short period of time, fixed broken trade deals, and fully tapped American energy, that prosperity would come thundering back at a record speed. And that is exactly what we did, and that is exactly what happened. Since my election, America has gained over 7 million jobs, a number unthinkable. I wouldn't say it, I wouldn't talk about it, but that was a number that I had in mind. The projection was 2 million, we did 7. More than 3 times the government's own projections. The unemployment rate is now less than 3.5%, and at 3.5%, that's a number that is the lowest in more than 50 years. The average unemployment rate for my administration is the lowest for any U.S. president in recorded history. We started off with reasonably high rate. For the first time in decades, we are no longer simply concentrating wealth in the hands of a few. We're concentrating and creating the most inclusive economy ever to exist. We are lifting up Americans of every race, color, religion, and creed. unemployment rates among African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Asian Americans have all reached record lows. African American youth unemployment has reached the lowest it's ever been in the history of our country. African American poverty has plummeted to the lowest rate ever recorded. The unemployment rate for women reached the lowest level since 1953, and women now comprise a majority of the American workforce. That's for the first time. The unemployment rate for veterans has dropped to a record low. The unemployment rate for disabled Americans has reached an all-time record low. Workers without a high school diploma have achieved the lowest unemployment rate recorded in U.S. history. Wages are rising across the board, and those at the bottom of the income ladder are enjoying the percentage by far largest gains. Workers' wages are now growing faster than management wages. Earnings growth for the bottom 10% is outpacing the top 10%, something that has not happened. Paychecks for high school graduates are rising faster than for college graduates. Young Americans just entering the workforce are also sharing in America's extraordinary prosperity. Since I took office, more than 2 million millennials have gotten jobs, and their wages have grown by nearly 5% annually, a number that was unthinkable. Nobody would have ever thought it was possible 3 years ago. A record number of Americans between the ages of 25 and 34 are now working. In the 8 years before I took office, over 300,000 working-age people left the workforce. In just 3 years in my administration, 3.5 million people have joined the workforce. 10 million people have been lifted off welfare in less than 3 years. Celebrating the dignity of work is a fundamental pillar of our agenda. This is a blue-collar boom. Since my election, the net worth of the bottom half of wage earners has increased by plus 47%, three times faster than the increase for the top 1%. Real median household income is at the highest level ever recorded. The American dream is back, bigger, better, and stronger than ever before. No one is benefiting more than America's middle class. We have created 1.2 million manufacturing and construction jobs, a number also unthinkable. After losing 60,000 factories under the previous two administrations, hard to believe when you hear 60,000 factories, America has now gained, in a very short period of time, 12,000 new factories under my administration, and the number is going up rapidly. We'll be beating the 60,000 number that we lost, except these will be bigger, newer, and the latest. Years of economic stagnation have given way to a roaring geyser of opportunity. U.S. stock markets have soared by more than 50% since my election, adding more than $19 trillion to household wealth and boosting 401ks, pensions, and college savings accounts for millions of hardworking families. And these great numbers are many things. And it's despite the fact that the Fed has raised rates too fast and lowered them too slowly. And even now, as the United States is by far the strongest economic power in the world, it's not even close. It was going to be close, but a lot of good things happened to us and some not so good things happened to certain other places. They're forced to compete, and we compete with nations that are getting negative rates, something very new, meaning they get paid to borrow money, something that I could get used to very quickly. Love that. Got to pay back your loan? Oh, how much am I getting? Nevertheless, we still have the best numbers that we've had in so many different areas. It's a conservative approach. And we have a tremendous upside potential. when all of the trade deals and the massive deregulation starts kicking in, which will be during this year, especially toward the end of the year. Those trade deals are starting to kick in already. The regulations are kicking in right now. And I see such tremendous potential for the future. We have not even started because the numbers we're talking about are massive. The time for skepticism is over. People are flowing back into our country. Companies are coming back into our country. Many of you who I know are coming back in with your plants and your factories. Thank you very much. America's newfound prosperity is undeniable, unprecedented, and unmatched anywhere in the world. America achieved this stunning turnaround not by making minor changes to a handful of policies, but by adopting a whole new approach centered entirely on the well-being of the American worker. Every decision we make on taxes, trade, regulation, energy, immigration, education, and more is focused on improving the lives of everyday Americans. We are determined to create the highest standard of living that anyone can imagine. And right now, that's what we're doing for our workers, the highest in the world. And we're determined to ensure that the working and middle class reap the largest gains. A nation's highest duty is to its own citizens. Honoring this truth is the only way to build faith and confidence in the market system. Only when governments put their own citizens first will people be fully invested in their national futures.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, it's your brother, Robert East. Welcome to this Class 4 Battlefield podcast segment. So, how about that Trump Davos speech? Some years back, in talking to a person that I know about joining a sorority, they were saying how, you know, they love the sorority, it's awesome, it's cool, and they are a member of a national sorority. It's a pretty big size one, I guess. It's national, so it has to be pretty big. But I asked them, you know, if there was anything crazy that they had to do to get in, and they go, no, you know. Of course, they couldn't really talk about it, but they did say that there was one sorority which they were invited to join, which they had declined to join. It was from another college, not the one they actually attended, but they were a well enough student, they got along with everybody, and they were really well connected to, you know, just because they were a nice person, to everyone who they met, that a person who was a member of the sorority had recommended them, even though they didn't even go to the college. And in essence, what they would have to do is they would transfer over to the college so they could become a member of the sorority. This was a bigger sorority. My friend is not particularly wealthy. I mean, They have a little money, but they're not hugely wealthy. They are black, which might be an attractive quality, because the sorority was just about as white as milk. So, you know, and this was back in the late 90s when this happened. In contemplating whether or not they would join the sorority, and maybe I might be using the wrong term. It might be a fraternity, in fact, because it's a sorority, I think, is women. Fraternity would be men, I believe. So, in joining this fraternity, they were going through their minds, and I apologize, you know, the reason why I got too confused is because I was going to use another story, which involved a woman, but it didn't do justice to what I needed to explain to you today. So I changed it at the last minute and just didn't pop out the sorority aspect of it, so fraternity. But in contemplating whether or not to join the fraternity, they went over, they met some of the people there, and immediately realized, you know, this was a big deal. If they joined this fraternity, this is one of those moves that would have a tremendous impact on their life. These kids that he was talking to, these were not the rich kids that he was used to dealing with. Most of the rich kids he was used to dealing with, you know, their parents made $300,000-$500,000 a year. That's some good money. But the parents of these children made, most of them, in the tens of millions of dollars a year. You know, these guys were players. They were hitters. And he really knew if he joined, it would be his whole life would change. And in fact, they told him that. They said, look, you know, you get into here, you're a good student. We know, you know, your grades, things like that. If you get into here, when you leave this college, you can write a ticket to anywhere you want to go. You name it, you can go there. When you get done with that college, if you want to go overseas, you write a ticket anywhere you want to go. This will open up doors unimaginable to a child, to a kid like you. He was really stuck about this. So he contacted his former football coach. His former football coach actually played in the NFL for a few years and decided to return to coaching young people, which was a passion of his. And so he talked to his coach about this amazing opportunity. And his coach said, look, it's a good idea on the basis, but there's always a catch to these things. There's always a catch to these things. And the coach recounted a story he had heard, which may or may not be true, of a very exclusive group of men. This wasn't a fraternity per se. And that when that group of men would invite somebody in to join the group, they would bind themselves to the group by doing something which the group sanctioned, which would either be embarrassing or could result in criminal charges being filed against them if it was ever discovered.
And the football coach told him, if you make this move, just realize, you know, there's going to be a trade-off. There is no free lunch at that level. None. Ultimately, my friend decided against going with the fraternity. Donald Trump has changed, ladies and gentlemen. Donald Trump has changed. From the moment he came out to speak to the nation after killing Mr. Qasem Soleimani, his voice, his cadence, his stature, his structure is different. He has changed. Now, there's two reasons why I think he's changed. At least two. Donald Trump wants to remain in office. I know a lot of my progressive friends do not want to even contemplate him remaining in office. But he does. For the last 3 years, he has been antagonistic towards the wealthy. Yes, yes, yes. He's given them money. He's done that, which has made them happy. But he has shirked every norm which they had set up to deceive the American public into believing that the wealthy were doing something, anything, everything sometimes, on behalf of that public and to benefit that public. Donald Trump has exposed their lie. Shirking their norms, he has exposed what they really are about. Thus, he erred in his arrogance when he decided to go after Joe Biden because he knew what was happening. He understood that that group that he's antagonizing was going to put up Joe Biden to defeat him. They were going to rig, and I'm still not confident that they're not going to rig this entire process to make sure Joe Biden is the winner. But he knew that. So, he went after him. In the newly gained majority by the Democrats, stepped forward and said, oh, no you don't. And went after him back. As the evidence began to mount, suggesting that Mr. Trump would be tried and probably found guilty if he allowed the evidence to be presented publicly, he became afraid. And a frightened man with dreams of imperial garb is a dangerous man. He had to signal that he was ready to play ball with the deep state. And I believe, truthfully, that's what Soleimani was. A signal that he was ready to play ball. Recall when he bombed Syria, or when the military bombed Syria under his suggestion, many people suggest, many commentators on the corporate mainstream media suggested that he would become more presidential, more president-like. And many were not very happy when that didn't materialize. His speaking patterns didn't sharpen. His willingness to stay on message didn't improve. Trump was still Trump. When he decided to kill Soleimani, I do not believe for a moment that Trump thought it through well enough to understand the consequences that would come in. But I do believe that it was a way of signaling that he was not only ready to play ball, but that he was ready to get serious and to do the work of the people who he knew he would need to mount a successful campaign against. Still, he was thanking Joe Biden, even though increasingly Bernie Sanders' name was probably popping up in his head. Because he didn't think it through, and because he had a lot of people egging him on, I believe he was shocked by the response. See, we didn't see the aftermath. We didn't see, or should I say hear, the phone calls he was getting. I will tell you this, though. Watching his statement, I could tell that there was immense pressure coming from Europe and the Middle East. Whatever was being told to him was disastrous, and it changed his entire composition. He became a very different, outwardly communicative person. That's the best way I can put it. The second reason that I believe this has also happened is he is starting to see internal polling that suggests he will be beaten in November. To say nothing about the fact that there is likely enough evidence to convict him. And I think he knows it. And I also think he believes that he really does not have all the Republican support that Mitch McConnell is exercising currently in the Senate. Trump does not have them sewed up. That is why McConnell has to act the way that he has to act. Because Trump doesn't have them sold up. And if the information was allowed to be laid out, it'd be over. Now, I've talked to you many times about internal polling. And I'm glad to see that many more people are starting to take that seriously. Because, you know, once you really understand what internal polling is and the money that people spend for it, you'd actually understand why it is far more reliable and important than the stuff that most of us get. I believe internal polling says a couple of things to Donald Trump. I believe internal polling is telling him that he is not as popular as he figured he'd be at this time period in his presidency. Number two, I believe that it's telling him that the Republicans are likely to take significant losses, even if he wins in November, that they will take significant losses, even if he wins. But, and this is the more important one, I believe the internal polling is telling him that if a person such as, like Bernie Sanders, is ran against him, it's no contest. States that the Democrats have dreamt of winning, polling suggests, internal polling says, that the Democrats under Sanders will win some of those states. Now, the bigger news from those internal polls, because, you know, you got to understand a couple of things about a lot of internal polls. The question of why is asked, and why is emphasized. And so many, many, many different answers to that why will be given. And then it'll be boiled down so the readers can make important decisions based on it. The Republican Party has done significant internal polling. I want to say quickly before I get into what I believe that internal polling has said, that the Republican Party understands that there's going to be a youth wave that's going to be washing over this country for the next 10 years. They're hoping it's only going to be for the next 4 years, but likely the next 10 years. These people are engaged. They know that. So now they have to figure out what do these young people want, and what can the Republican Party do to bring them back home? Secondly, they're getting worried because states such as Kentucky are starting to lean Democrat. When they are doing their internal polling, they're getting shocked with how many people are leaning Democrat in places like Kentucky. But here's what the internal polling is saying about Donald Trump, because that's important. Many times, candidates, parties will say, we are doing internal polling to figure out what voters like about you and what voters don't like about you. Especially they'll do this heading into an election year. Those internal polls told Donald Trump that he's erratic, that a lot of people do not see him as presidential because he is incapable of staying on script and on message, and that he doesn't present himself as presidential because he speaks in such a gruff way that his message is garbled. And ladies and gentlemen, it is because of that information, I believe, that we have new Donald Trump. That we have new Donald Trump. Obviously, he's still the old Donald Trump with some polish. But I'm confident his advisors got into his ear and said, listen, Mr. Trump, if you really are serious about getting reelected, if you are really serious about taking on a person such as Bernie Sanders, your spiel ain't gonna work. You have to clean yourself up, and you have to be articulate enough to communicate with the public, or else you will be a one-term president. Now, I'm interested to see if this continues. I'm interested to see if this continues because, you know, he's Donald Trump. You know, let's just be honest about it. But if this continues, I believe that'll be a signal that this internal polling has been done, it has been listened to, and Donald Trump has taken it seriously. It's a possibility also that alongside with this internal polling information, that Donald Trump received some information prior to killing Soleimani that should have deterred him from killing Soleimani. But he was gung-ho, and he didn't listen. Which may, in fact, be, you know, what I heard people referencing, that he was given a list of ideas of things to do. And the list, as Larry Wilkerson said, goes from, you know, the most pragmatic, the one maybe with the least consequences, all the way down to the, you know, it's an option, but you know, that's nuclear. We really ain't going to do, we're not going to do that. You know, that's the list. And it's possible that Mr. Trump got some information, which he should have listened to, which would have kept him away from that latter part of that list, and he didn't listen. And after everything blew up with aftermath of Soleimani's death, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have used the word blown up, but after the world reacted, and he had to see that reaction because of that power that he has, it might have scared him straight. I mean, that's equally plausible. I do believe that it's not coincidence that it's happening going into an election year. I don't believe it is coincidental that he kept saying this was a bad terrorist, this is the world's number one terrorist. You know, can't get Osama bin Laden twice, so you know, you gotta invent a guy. But I think we have to be careful because Mr. Trump has changed. And while I like to believe that it's because he got scared straight and he's taking stuff seriously, I don't buy that. I don't buy that. I really don't buy that. His statements on climate change, where he said, you know, it's real and, you know, it's something that we have to take seriously and blah, 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 blah. I mean, think about that. The man has been a climate denier for the last 3 years, and then suddenly, in the last week or so, he's talking about climate change is real, we need to take immediate action, blah, blah, blah. Something's happened with him. Something has happened. And I may not even have, you know, my prescriptions may not be right. There may be other stuff going on that I just don't know about. But something has happened with Donald Trump. And I really think it behooves us to figure out kind of what happened with him. Because, you know, a lot of people don't take Donald Trump seriously. They really don't take Donald Trump seriously, and I think they do that at their own peril. They don't take him seriously, and they don't believe that he matters, but he really is the president of the United States. What he does matters. So, you know, we have to kind of figure that out. I think it would be beneficial for all of us if we knew what happened with Donald Trump, you know, after Soleimani's death. With the blood in the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear. I'm going to close this section out here, ladies and gentlemen, and come back on the other side. And a country is drifting to war. With more class war. There's a shadow podcast. On the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom. And we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own. Or the people who find they can't take anymore. And they pick up a gun.